You're listening to This Week in Fantasy Baseball.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Fantasy Baseball. I'm Lee Keller, joined by John Kuh. Here comes the Vaughn. We had an exciting call-up by the Braves with Vaughn Grissom, who we'll talk about later, and before you ask, no, he isn't related to Marquise. On today's show, we will go over the injury notes and roster moves, talk about some of the standout player performances from the past week, and later on, we'll be joined by pitcherless writer Dylan Drummy to talk about his latest article, How Do You Objectively Measure a Trade? But before all of that, John, how has your week been? What's going on today?
Yeah, it's been really good, actually. Friday, I got to go witness Tyler Molly's first start as a Twin.
Very cool. Which, I saw that on Twitter. Very nice.
Yeah. It did not go as well as we hoped. He did give up four homers in classic flyball pitcher fashion.
Yep.
Everyone's like, oh, Molly's going to a bigger park. And it's true. He did go to a bigger park, but he still managed to give up four homers. So, you know, it is what it is. I'll just equate it to first start jitters. But it was cool, too, because we'll talk about it later in the recaps, but I got to see my second walk-off win of the season live. So
Ooh. That
was fun. But in more fun news, it's actually my favorite part of the baseball season because it is officially Little League season
on
TV. And I don't know why. I love watching Little League baseball. It's something about how you've got these 4'11", 12-year-olds facing off against these 6'2", you know, 12-year-old pitchers, and they're like, yeah, these kids are the same age, and yeah, that 4'11 kid's gonna get a hit off this guy because his strike zone is so small. I don't know why. I love watching Little League Baseball. It's one of the best things of the year.
Little League Baseball is phenomenal, and believe it or not, I was actually almost on TV. I was a part of my Williamsport team on Long Island, and we were one win away from making it to states. Ooh. And then after that, if we won that round, we would have went on to the TV show.
Mm-hmm.
So we didn't win, obviously. Otherwise, I would have had a much cooler story. But I was that 4'11 kid getting a hit off of every pitcher. And
right, yeah.
It's so funny to watch them. Now, I swear, when I was watching DeGrom pitch the other day, alongside it was also the Little League World Series. Not the actual World Series, just one of the games in the tournament. But
yep.
One of the kids was, I don't know, he had to be 3'8", and he pulled a hit to right field, and the right fielder tried to throw him out at first and overthrew it, and a run scored. It was just hilarious to watch, and it's just funny to think that, like, that was me at one point. Like, I was that 3'8" kid.
Right, yeah. And it's really fun, too, because, like, you can't really, like, get mad at these kids for, like, making errors or things like that. Like, yesterday the game I was watching, you know, the team made like five errors in one inning.
Yeah,
like, yeah, the highest, you know, ball I've ever played was t-ball when I was six, you know, so I have nothing to say about how hard it is to make a play at second, but it's just always fun to see, you know, these kids out there just having fun playing baseball. And you know, a lot of them are never going to make it to the majors or, you know, any sort of notable achievements in baseball, but, you know, they're able to say that they at least made it to, you know, regional finals or something like that. I think that's just cool.
Hey, the next Todd Frazier can be out there. You know, he was on the Little League World Series.
That's true. Yeah. Well, actually, I think there's a guy we're going to talk about later in this write-up who also had, like, a game-winning hit in the Little League World Series. So,
oh, wow.
Keep an eye out for that.
What's really funny is there's a meme with Todd Frazier, because every time he came up on the Mets broadcast on, like, ESPN, they'd be like, did you know he won the Little League World Series? It's like his only fun fact that he's from New Jersey. Yeah. And he was in the Little League World Series, and they say it all the time. So it's a meme.
Right. There's nothing else notable.
No, nothing else at all. It's just, hey, he was on the Little League World Series and he's from New Jersey.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. So you didn't play any Little League at all?
No, I hated the idea of a baseball coming at my head. I was a soccer guy. So.
Oh, okay.
Which is, I mean, ironic because, I mean, it's still a ball coming at your head for the most part.
Yeah.
But, like, it's a bigger ball at least, so you could get out of the way. It's not flying at your face at, like, you know, 50 miles an hour.
Yeah.
Yeah, so I was a soccer kid growing up, not a baseball kid.
Okay, yeah, I have a fun little story. I won't go too deep into it, but I was really late into Little League. I always wanted to play, but my parents never signed me up, and it kind of coincided with bowling season as well, so practice and tryouts were always early in the morning when we bowled. Mm-hmm. And one year I said, Dad, I really want to do it. And he's like, okay, yeah, we'll do it this year, great. So we brought all my stuff, and I was going to go from bowling league to baseball tryouts. Well, we left a little bit late, and we forgot about the tryouts, and I got there as it was ending. So
oh, no.
I get there, and I'm hustle into the field and they go, "Hey, do you have all the paperwork?" And I was like, "No, where do you get paperwork?" He's like, "It's inside." And I told my dad, I was like, "Dad, go get the paperwork. We didn't do anything. Like, go." So I run out there with my bag, with my bat and my glove. And I just go up there and I'm expecting like a full tryout, like full swings, catch balls in the outfield, pitch, just like a bunch of things, right? But like I said, they were ending. It was wrapping up. So I had my glove and they go, "Okay, kid, go in the outfield and just wait there." I said, "Okay." So he threw me one pop-up. No joke. He just took a ball, threw it straight up in the air. I caught it. He goes, "Okay, great. We'll call you and tell you what team you're on in the next coming week." So I was like, "What?" My dad was still inside filling out paperwork.
Oh, yeah.
And I'm waiting for him to come out. He goes, "The tryout's over?" I said, "Yeah, we were late, Dad. I did one thing. They threw one pop-up to me." So I get a call. I'm on a little league team. They picked me with the last pick in the draft because they didn't know who I was. I was like a throw-in. I was the kid who picked grass, quote-unquote, you know what I mean?
Right,
so
exactly.
I get to my first practice for this team, and I'm fielding everything. I'm taking hacks, and I'm doing great. And the coach goes up to my dad and goes, "Did you guys just move here?" And he goes, "No, we've lived here for pretty much ever." And he goes,
"Yeah,
this is his first year in Little League?" He goes, "Yeah. He never played at all, and this year we finally were able to do it." And he goes, "Where was he this whole time?" He goes, "He just didn't have any time to play." He goes, "We got him with our last pick in the draft, and he's like the second best kid on our team. What is going on here?" And I literally was rookie of the year that year. I went to an all-star game for the Little League, and I ended up, after that, I went to the Little League World Series Williamsport team, and I played in travel ball, and it was really, really cool. But my Little League was very short-lived, but it was epic because I took everyone by surprise. They actually took me first overall in the next year's draft, the same coach, after having me in the last pick in the draft. So I went from last pick to first pick. So little glow-up there, little glow-up.
Yeah. You're the guy that got selected in the 26th round and then somehow just, you know, blew up on fantasy baseball. And then all of a sudden it's a genuine first rounder next year.
Yeah, yeah. I'm the Mike Trout of the draft in Little League. And I'm the Trey Turner of free agents of fantasy baseball.
Yeah, exactly.
But that was my Little League World Series story. Otherwise, for this week, nothing much really went on for me. It was just a normal week. Been a little busy, but we don't want to get into that. But before we get into the meat and potatoes of this podcast, I'd like to remind all of you that you could follow our podcast on Twitter at ThisWeekPL, and you could send us your questions, comments, and concerns to our email at ThisWeekPLpod@gmail.com. If you want us to talk about a certain player or anything fantasy-related, be sure to write us an email or send us a tweet. And lastly, make sure that you subscribe to or follow the podcast on whatever streaming platform that you listen to your podcasts on. We're on all of them, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, and all of the rest of them. So make sure you follow us there and leave a 5-star review so we can be separated from all of the other podcasts out there and people know that it's a good show worth listening to. But let's get into the injury notes and roster moves. We start off with Tim Anderson of the White Sox. He was placed on the 10-day IL on Tuesday, August 9th, with a sagittal band tear in the middle finger of his left hand. I don't even know if I said that right. I've never heard of a sagittal band tear. He underwent surgery to repair it on Thursday and is expected to miss 4 to 6 weeks. John, Tim Anderson has been a huge headache this whole season. He's been suspended like 3 times. He's been on the injured list twice. What's going on with Tim Anderson?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, like, he's also one of the most exciting players in baseball. So, you know, I've been on the receiving end of watching a lot of Tim Anderson web gems as he, you know, gets a line out on a Twins player.
Oh, yeah.
So it sucks for the White Sox, at least. I mean, this basically means they have no shot of competing for the division with their star player out. Yeah, tough to see, I guess. It sucks for your fantasy teams if you had him as your starting shortstop, for sure.
Yeah, I don't even know who the White Sox replace him with at shortstop. Like, it's got to be someone real deep. But
yeah, it's tough.
If you drafted Tim Anderson early in your drafts, you're definitely not happy right now because he hasn't been bad when he's been on the field, but he's rarely been on the field. He's getting suspended. He's getting hurt. I mean, it's just a mess. Tim Anderson, what are you doing, buddy? Next, Matt Carpenter of the Yankees was placed on the 10-day IL on Tuesday, August 9th, with a fractured left foot. Carpenter fouled the ball off of his foot to sustain this injury and is expected to miss 6 to 8 weeks, but he is expecting to play again this season. Kyle Schwarber of the Phillies left Thursday's game on August 11th with a mild right calf strain. He's apparently day-to-day for now, so hopefully Schwarber won't have to go on the IL and was able to avoid a serious injury. Dustin May of the Dodgers will make another minor league rehab start at AAA Oklahoma City on Sunday before rejoining the Dodgers rotation. He's looked really good in his rehab starts with a 26-5 strikeout-to-walk ratio and a 1.69 ERA. At one point, he even touched 99 miles per hour. If he's available in your league, now is the time to stash him. I wish he was available in my leagues, but he is not. People have been putting him on the IL and stashing him away for quite some time now. Clayton Kershaw of the Dodgers was given an epidural for his back on Saturday, August 6th. There's still no timetable for his return. I just wanted to mention this because I've never heard of anyone receiving an epidural except for women who are giving birth, so I thought that was kind of funny. Have you ever heard of anybody getting an epidural besides a woman giving birth?
I feel like I have, but I mean, this basically just means that like Kershaw's in a lot of pain.
Oh yeah, real bad. Julio Rodriguez of the Mariners remains on track to rejoin the Mariners on Friday. He's been out with soreness in his right wrist. Jesse Winker of the Mariners has missed two straight games and is considered day-to-day with back spasms. Lance McCullers Jr. of the Astros will make his 2022 season debut on Saturday against the Athletics. He's returning from a flexor tendon injury in his right arm. In his rehab starts, he had a lower velocity than normal and was knocked around a bit, so I'm not expecting too much from him in this first start back, but he's definitely someone that you want to keep an eye on, and maybe if he pitches well, slot him right back in your rotation. George Springer of the Blue Jays was placed on the 10-day IL on Saturday, August 6th, retroactive to August 5th, with right elbow inflammation. His elbow has given him a lot of trouble this season, so hopefully it's not a long-term problem for Springer, but keep an eye on him. And last but not least, Vaughn Grissom was called up by the Braves on Wednesday, August 10th. In his first MLB game, he went 2-for-4 with 2 runs, a homer, 2 RBI, and a stolen base. His first major league hit was the home run, and he's the youngest player in MLB history to record a homer and a steal in his MLB debut. He'll be playing second base for the time being, a spot where the Braves have been weak since Albies landed on the IL way back when. And on Yahoo, he currently has shortstop eligibility, so we'll have shortstop and second base very soon. So if you need a middle infielder, this kid looks pretty good. He had a 324, 405, 494 slash line with 14 home runs and 27 stolen bases in 96 games between high A and double A. So definitely looks promising. John, any notes about any of these guys, mainly Vaughn?
Only note I have about Vaughn is that I immediately tried to pick him up in all of my leagues.
Yeah, he's a big guy. I didn't realize how gigantic he was. When I think someone comes up from double A, I just expect like a Nick Allen from the Athletics where he's 4'12" and not built. But Vaughn Grissom looks gigantic.
Yeah, I mean, obviously there was the log jam at second and at shortstop. So, you know, it's understandable why Atlanta didn't call him up earlier.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, this might be a fun catalyst for them as they try to end the season well. I don't know where they are playoff-wise. I mean, I can't imagine they're that close. They're probably in the wild card hunt, but I don't know. Maybe this is the catalyst that they need.
Yeah, they are in the wild card hunt right now. I believe they're 7.5 games behind the Mets in the NL East.
Okay.
So they're a little bit behind, but they're making their way for that NL wildcard spot since the playoff format changed. So the Braves are definitely in it still, and this might be a big boon. And if there's a comp that I can make for him, it's kind of a cop-out because it's his teammate, but like Michael Harris.
Huh. Yeah.
I feel like he could be the Michael Harris of the middle infield because he had 14 homers and 27 stolen bases between high A and double A, so a little bit more speed-driven, not as much power, but man, he looks real good. I'm trying to pick him up everywhere if I can.
Yep, same. Well, moving on to our weekly performance recaps, just as a reminder, we get pretty much all of this information from our hitter articles and our pitcher articles of our pitcher list. The Batter's Box article and the SP Roundup articles are incredible resources to read, especially as the seasons are winding down and you're trying to just pick up the right guys for your playoff run and you don't know who's been doing well. Definitely check those articles out. But getting right into it, starting with the weekend, August 5th through 7th, I want to start off with my boy, Nick Gordon of the Twins. Got to watch this live. He went 3-for-5 with a double, a home run, 2 runs, and 3 RBIs. I remember audibly groaning when I found out that the Twins starting lineup was going to consist of Gordon in left, Mark Contreras in center, and Jake Cave in right. I was really hoping that Buxton was going to start that night because it's always fun to see Bucks play. But yeah, that's a pretty bad outfield, all things considered. But they ended up with a pretty solid night. Contreras and Gordon both hit homers. And Gordon was definitely the star of the game. He had a double, he had a 3-run shot. And most importantly, he had the game-winning run on a fielder's choice. It was beautiful. See the highlight if you haven't. It's one of the really interesting, you know, heads-up base running plays, I think, of the season. But yeah, with all the injuries that the Twins are dealing with in the outfield, Alex Kirilloff is now out for season. Max Kepler is coming back from an ankle injury. Gordon's going to get pretty consistent playing time. And since June 1st, he's actually slashing 231, 362, and 49 in 149 plate appearances. And if you like short sample sizes, more recently, his OPS was 793 in July and then a crazy 1085 in August. I don't think he's going to keep it up. But that's a guy that you could definitely stash in a deep league, maybe as your fifth outfielder. He's going to be playing, and he's definitely been improving his hit tool. So, you know, check out Nick Gordon if you have a spot that you need to fill.
I remember when Nick Gordon was like a top prospect.
Yeah.
Crazy.
He was drafted fifth by the Twins 7 years ago. So obviously he had the pedigree with his dad and his brother.
Yep.
You know, he's had some pretty tough years. He was basically having issues like keeping on weight. He was like 130 pounds, I think, like last year or a couple years ago.
I can relate to that.
Yeah, so he didn't have like the major league build, but he's been able to, you know, keep on the weight. He's still, you know, a really skinny kid, but I say kid, we're probably around the same age. But yeah, Nick Gordon definitely is kind of one of those guys who I think is going to contribute for the Twins. I just don't know if he's going to contribute for your fantasy team down the stretch. Moving on to Saturday, we got Will Smith of the Dodgers going 2-for-4 with a home run, 2 runs, 3 RBIs, and a stolen base. I feel like we often overlook Will Smith in the best catcher conversation because he's just so consistent, but really unflashy. He currently leads all catchers in home runs and RBIs. He's also top 5 in runs, average, OBP, and slug, so definitely just a guy who contributes in pretty much all the categories you want him to. He showed off on Saturday with a homer, 3 RBIs, and he even got a steal. You should definitely expect to see these more days like this down the stretch for Will Smith, albeit probably without the speed. After all, his career high is 3 stolen bases. And then Derek Hall of the Phillies went 2-for-5 with 2 homers, 3 runs, 2 RBIs, and a walk on Sunday. Remember Derek Hall? We talked about him a couple podcasts ago. He hit 2 homers in his second major league game and then followed up with a homer in his next game. It just felt like the Phillies had just found a midseason replacement for Bryce Harper. Well, Hall did cool off a little bit afterwards. He ended up slashing 247, 284, 468 in July, showing the rookie tendencies of striking out a lot and not walking enough, but still, you know, be able to hit the ball for extra bases, which is, you know, good for a rookie. The Phillies had him batting cleanup pretty much all throughout July. They did move him back to 6 in the order for the last week or so, but he's still showing off the power a little bit. On Sunday, obviously, he had those 2 shoulder shots as well as a walk, which is good to see. It's hard to see what the rest of season outlook for Hall is. The advanced metrics definitely look really good. He hits the ball hard, fairly consistently, has good expected stats. He's still a rookie, though, and until that strikeout rate goes down, it's going to be tough to rely on him day in and day out.
Yeah, the one note for Derek Hall, he rarely plays against lefties. He always plays against righties, and he smashes them, but lefties, he doesn't play much against. I don't think the Phillies have many other options, so maybe he'll play a little bit more, but yeah, he doesn't play much against lefties. So if you are picking him up for fantasy purposes, just know that he's probably going to get a few days off depending on who's on the mound that day.
Right. And he's not really a defensive substitute. So with Schwarber getting hurt, that's not going to mean anything for Derek Hall's play time.
Yep.
Moving on to pitchers, we have Robbie Ray of the Mariners. Went 7 innings with 1 run, 5 hits, 2 walks, and 10 strikeouts against the Angels on Friday. He's had an interesting follow-up season to his Cy Young winning campaign last year. Obviously, it's kind of hard to, you know, follow up a Cy Young campaign unless you're an elite pitcher like Corbin Burns, I guess. The ERA and the WHIP have been up this year. He's striking out batters less, he's walking them more, but he's still an elite force, and against a pretty powerless Angels lineup, with the exception of Shohei Ohtani, Ray carved them up. Every pitch was working beautifully. The four-seamer and the slider both had plus 40% CSW, and the sinker was also pretty effective in getting strikes. Max Fried of Atlanta went 6 innings with 2 runs, 6 hits, 1 walk, and 5 strikeouts against the Mets on Saturday. Fried just feels like an underrated ace. He doesn't make the news a lot. He doesn't have flashy strikeout games, but he gives you solid performances every single time. He's also a complete workhorse with only 4 starts his entire season where he failed to get 6 innings. And if you throw out the starts at the beginning of the season when he was getting stretched out, you know, he's only going 70, 80 pitches, it's only 2 starts where he hasn't gone at least 6. Nice job against the Met in the Battle of the Maxes. Obviously, Max Scherzer, the other Max, who also pitched lights out. And then Jacob deGrom, obviously with the Mets again. 5.2 innings, 2 runs, 1 hit, 1 walk, and 12 strikeouts against Atlanta. We're making up for lost time by pretty much talking about every deGrom start. I don't think there's going to be ever a deGrom start we don't talk about on this podcast.
No, I don't think so either.
Yeah, how do you not when he threw 5 perfect innings? At one point in the game, his slider had earned 18 whiffs on 18 swings, which is insane. He finished the night with 18 whiffs on 20 swings, one of those swings being a foul. So you know, still really, really good. The rust was there a little bit. He gave up 2 runs in the sixth, but I'll be honest, I don't even care. This was vintage DeGrom, and we're so lucky to have him back.
Yeah, the one note for Fried is he is a wizard for quality start leagues. If you need a quality start pitcher, Max Fried has been great now for 2 years. He was top five in the league, I believe, last year in quality starts. So Max Fried, epic for quality starts. And then Jacob DeGrom, I mean, it's such a treat, like you said. It's amazing, especially as a Mets fan. Just watching that start, I was hoping he would give up a hit, only because I knew it would be like a Clayton Kershaw issue earlier in the year where he was not going to do the full thing for a perfect game. He was only going to go 6 or 7 innings with 75 pitches or less. So once I saw the perfect game going, I go, oh my God, please just walk somebody or give up a hit. Just, I do not want to see him come out in the seventh with a perfect game. I will lose my mind because he can do it. He's going to do it if he's in. But I also want him to pitch in the playoffs. And I'm just so excited about DeGrom. I mean, the 18 whiffs on 18 sliders was absolutely insane. 18 for 18 on sliders. Yeah. They swung 18 times at 18 sliders and missed every single time. And then Michael Harris got a foul ball off one and I think got out on one.
I think so. I think that's what it was, yeah. But he still hit it, but yeah, it was an out. Yeah.
I mean, come on, man. There's not many in the game like him. And if anybody thinks that he's not the best pitcher in the game, once again, I'll reiterate this, we can have a discussion about it because you're wrong.
Yeah. It's hard to argue. I mean, the 12 strikeouts is kind of insane. Like, he was just like, oh, that's right, I am this dominant. Let's go.
Yeah, and this doesn't even show how dominant he was. It says he has 2 earned runs, of course. He gave up a walk to the 9-hitter, which he just missed by a little bit. And then Dansby Swanson, he just leaked one a little bit in the pound zone for Swanson, and he hit a home run off of it. But that was the only hit that they got off of DeGrom, and it was at the end of his performance. So he very well could have went 7 scoreless, perfect 15 strikeout if he was stretched out. But DeGrom is amazing.
Yeah.
Moving on to Monday, August 8th, we have the Batter's Box article. Whoa, Nelly from Mark Stubinger. We start off with the title boy, Nelson Velasquez of the Cubs. He went 3 for 4 with a homer, a run, and an RBI. Since the Cubs aren't in contention, the organization is letting some of their younger players take a shot, and Velasquez is one of them. Now, he isn't playing every day and is most likely not someone that you'd roster unless you're in the deepest of leagues, but he's a name to look out for. He's 23 years old, and after Monday's game, he's reached 100 MLB plate appearances. In that time, he's slashing .239, .307, .489 with 6 home runs and 2 stolen bases. Velasquez hits the ball hard with a barrel percentage of over 15% and topping out with a max exit velocity of 111.2. If he ever gets consistent playing time, he's someone you might want to roster. But right now, he's just someone for the waiver wire. And then Matt Chapman of the Blue Jays went 2 for 3 with a homer, 2 runs, an RBI, and a walk. To start this season, Chapman looked borderline droppable. However, he's turned it around in a big way. He's currently got a slash line of .242, .322, .474, accompanied by 22 home runs and 59 RBI. He's actually hit 7 home runs since the All-Star break, which is the second most, only trailing Aaron Judge, which, I mean, if you're trailing Aaron Judge in something, that's probably a good thing because he's an animal. And although third base has been bad overall, Chapman has been one of the solid contributors throughout the entire season. So if you have Matt Chapman, you're probably happy about it.
Yeah, I got to see one of those 7 home runs up and close. So yeah, Chapman definitely, you know, he was kind of interesting because when he moved from the A's to the Blue Jays, everyone was like, oh, you know, he's better offense and he'll get more RBIs. And he did have a pretty slow start, probably just getting acclimated to new teammates and things like that. But yeah, he's really come into his own. He's become one of those guys that you can rely on. You know, he's not like a Devers or a Machado, but he's good enough that you don't have to worry about him.
Yeah, he's that next tier down from those guys for me. He's the top of that next tier down. It goes Joe Ram in a tier of his own, then Devers, Machado, Nolan Arenado, and then probably Bobby Witt, you jump in there as well with third base eligibility. And then it probably goes like Matt Chapman. He's the leadoff of the next tier. And then Chris Bryant as well, if he retains third base eligibility.
Yeah, or is healthy.
Or is healthy for more than 42 games, yeah. Moving on to pitchers from Monday, we have the SP Roundup article, Zach to the Future by Nick Pollock. We start off with, yet again, the title boy, Zach Gallen of the Diamondbacks. He went 7 innings pitched, no earned runs, 3 hits, 2 walks, and 8 strikeouts against the Pirates. What a great start from Gallen, who has been having a really great season this year. Of course, it came against the Pirates, and in his last 10 starts, the only 4 really good ones came across bad offenses like the Reds, the Nationals, the Giants, and Monday's Pirates. However, Gallen has had a 3.12 ERA and a 1.02 whip with 114 strikeouts in 118.1 innings pitched, so he's exactly what you could have wanted when you drafted him in the 8th to 12th round range. In this start, he had a 31% CSW with 15 whiffs, and he had a 37% CSW on both his curveball and changeup. He's someone that I expect, if healthy, to take a big step forward in 2023, but I feel like we've been saying that for ages now, though, so I don't really know. And then we have Cole Irvin of the Athletics, who went 8 innings pitched with 1 earned run, 5 hits, no walks, and 6 strikeouts against the Angels. What in the Vargas rule, Batman? Cole Irvin has a 2.92 ERA and a 1.03 whip for the season. Let me repeat that. A 2.92 ERA for the season. That's just ridiculous. He isn't someone that pitches with high velocity or someone that has the nastiest breaking stuff, but he's a great pitcher. Irvin's a fly ball pitcher predominantly, which makes his home park of Ring Central Coliseum, which, by the way, I had to look that up. That's the Athletics Coliseum name, Ring Central Coliseum. That's horrible. What a bad name. But it gives him a huge advantage pitching there for his home park. He also doesn't strike out a lot of guys with 84 strikeouts and 123.1 innings pitched. However, Irvin has been getting the job done with 7 consecutive quality starts, so just keep starting him and enjoy the ride.
Yeah, it's kind of funny looking at Irvin's Savant page because it's just blue.
Like,
it's like
blue.
This guy's a 2.92 ERA and a 1.03 whip, and it's like his expecting batting average is in the 30th percentile. His expected slugging is on the 15th percentile.
Gross.
Like, this guy's just making it work.
Yeah.
Which is hilarious. I don't get it. I'd be interested to see what like his Sierra and his FIP are. But that's a really interesting tidbit. I didn't realize he was doing that well. And then just your weekly reminder that we may have cursed Zach Gallen. So
yeah, unfortunately, we just have not been lucky in that regard. But also for Cole Irvin, yeah, 7 consecutive quality starts is fantastic. He's been unreal,
yeah.
Kind of like Martin Perez, which I don't remember our bet if I said top 20 or top 30 pitcher.
It was top 30.
Top 30? Okay, yeah. Great. Because on Yahoo, if you sort it by pitching, I think he's like 18.
Oh, really?
So looking pretty good.
All right, we'll see how that. We'll see how that.
Only
ends
a few
up.
More weeks, Perez. Hang in there, buddy.
Right, exactly. Well, moving on to Tuesday's games, we got sipping on some boba tea from Jim Chatterton. Starting off with the lead boy, Bo Bichette of the Jays, 2-for-4 with 2 runs, 2 homers, and 4 RBIs. He exploded for 2 homers against the Orioles. He batted in 4 RBIs to raise his season slash line to 263, 304, 436. It's still well below his career marks, but his career marks are actually kind of flawed because he had that one amazing season last year and then 2 seasons preceding that where I think he played less than 50 games in both. So it's hard to fault him for being below his career marks when his career marks are basically defined by one amazing season.
Yeah.
It's important to remember that, especially since Bo has been highly ranked, right? He was the top 5 pick in fantasy drafts this year. Other guys were expecting him to meet, you know, top 3 shortstop in that conversation with Tatis and Turner. But he's only 24. I think the future is still bright. He has days like this, right, where he hits 2 homers. And you have to think that he'll figure it out eventually. And then Nick Prado of the Royals went 3-for-8 with a double, a home run, a run, and 3 RBIs. Fun fact of the day, 11 years ago, Nick Prado had the game-winning hit in the Little League World Series. So,
oh, wow. So that's the guy. Yeah, I got it.
That's the guy, yeah, Nick Prado. So, yeah, you know, one of those guys usually ends up being a major leaguer. It's kind of fitting that's the guy with the, you know, the game-winning hit.
Yeah, fun fact. So I mentioned Todd Frazier, but also 2 other major leaguers, Michael Conforto and Cody Bellinger, were also in the Little League World Series.
Oh, there you go.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, with Nick Prado, obviously he's with a bunch of other rookies in Kansas City. It's really hard to keep track of all of them, to be honest. Prado, I think, like, made his debut in Toronto because, you know, 10 players on their team basically said, we aren't traveling. And so the Royals, basically their AAA team up to Toronto, and they actually did pretty well against Gausman. That's still one of those starts that's kind of burned in my head. But yeah, he's been a pretty highly rated prospect this season. I think he was like number 64 in MLB.com's, you know, top 100 prospects last year. His batting average, though, is not pretty. It's like pretty near the Mendoza line. He doesn't have a lot of counting stats, unfortunately. But he did show off the power. He got a homer against the White Sox in the second game of their doubleheader on Tuesday. He projects as a 3 true outcomes hitter. I was looking at his stats, and it's kind of insane. He has a 32.5% K rate and a 13.3% walk rate.
Wow.
If you take either of those numbers without the other number, it's like, oh my goodness, this guy's either really good or really bad.
Yeah, yeah.
However, he still needs to hit the ball hard consistently at a major league level. He only has an 18.1% hard contact rate, so he really isn't contacting the ball hard on a frequent basis. And I mean, hey, he's a rookie. He's still learning. He got called up without really expecting anything. But I don't know if you saw this. It was actually a really cool picture of Nick Prado next to Eric Hosmer.
Okay.
When the Royals were facing the Red Sox, and it was kind of looking at, you know, the future first baseman for the Royals, and then obviously, you know, their first baseman of legend, Eric Hosmer. Just kind of fun, you know, passing the torch sort of thing. Just thinking about baseball, it's kind
of
cool.
Yeah, the Royals have a lot of prospects up right now. You got MJ Melendez, of course, Nick Prado. You've got Vinny Pasquantino, which out of all three of those, I think Vinny Pasquantino is probably the most exciting, then MJ Melendez, then probably Nick Prado. But Prado, great game from him in the doubleheader.
Yeah, and you still have Bobby Witt, of course, too. So, you know, that the future looks pretty bright for Kansas City. We'll just see if their pitching can kind of come along. Brady Singer obviously had some pretty good games recently.
Yeah.
He's had some ridiculous strikeout numbers. Yeah, so the Royals, obviously, and it's the AL Central, so weak division. You know, they might be able to compete in another 2 years, possibly.
Yep.
So, yeah. Moving on to pitchers with the My O Michaelis article from Nick Pollock. Starting off with Luis Castillo, the Mariners, who went 8 innings, 0 earned runs, 3 hits, 2 walks, and 7 strikeouts against the Yankees. After all the rumors of Castillo going to the Yanks and then finally ending up at the Mariners, only to have his first 2 starts go against the Yankees, Luis Castillo is showing why he was worth the prospect haul that the Reds got with 8 dominant innings, shutting down the best offense in baseball. The Bronx Bombers only managed 3 singles against Castillo on 18 balls in play. It's just a shame that it ended up as a no decision. That was a really cool game, if you managed to catch that, with Luis Torrens, I think, walking off the game in the 13th inning. So, fun night. Gerrit Cole, though, on the other side of the bump. The Yankees obviously went 7 innings with 0 earned runs, 4 hits, no walks, and 8 strikeouts against the Mariners. We do have to mention Cole here because the last time he was up against the Mariners, they decided to tag him for 3 homers in the first inning for 6 runs. He came back with a vengeance and a classic pitcher's duel with Castillo, even if it only came with 9 whiffs. It worked for Cole, though, and that's why he's an ace. It was just a fun pitching duel, and Gerrit Cole is Gerrit Cole. He's going to be good even when the stuff isn't there. And frankly, it would have been really sick to see both of them, you know, attempt to throw a complete game shutout. But that's pitching these days.
Yeah, that was a great game to watch. Castillo and Cole were dominant. And it really makes you think, hey, man, if Luis Castillo went to the Yankees, maybe the Yankees should have gave up a little bit more and tried to get him instead of the Mariners. Because now you got Frankie Montas and he's been not too great so far. So
yeah,
makes you think, man. And also, I'm surprised you didn't talk about Miles Michaelis. You love talking about Michaelis. And this
I do,
kind of wild.
Oh, my goodness, that was okay. So we're going to take a little segue here because I have to rant a little bit about this.
Apologies, by the way, to all the Miles Michaelis rosterers because you got lit up, and I'm sorry.
Yeah, so I have Michaelis in I think 2 of my leagues, and one of them is a points league, and pretty much you always start a pitcher in a points league because they're going to end up positive usually. I didn't start him in a head-to-head because he's like, oh, he's up against Colorado, he's probably going to give up, you know, like 4 runs and like maybe give up 10 hits because it's Colorado.
Yep.
And then I look at the line later, it's like 2.2 innings, 14 hits, 10 runs. I'm like, oh dear. Like, that's not even a good like points league start.
No.
Like, that's legitimately like a negative 20 points right there, negative 30 points.
Yep.
And yeah, I'm glad I didn't start Michaelis. You shouldn't start him in Colorado for sure. He's not that good of a pitcher. No pitcher is really like that good in Colorado. Even Kershaw isn't good in Colorado sometimes. So wow, what a start from Michaelis. I am so sorry that it had to happen like that, but you know what, I still have faith. He has a decent matchup coming up this next week. I think he goes against the Brewers at home, so still holding on to faith that Michaelis will still be the best Toby of the year.
Yeah, I don't see that changing at all either. He had all of his regression hit him in one game. So let's just be happy that it all came that time. And now he can go back to being a good pitcher.
Yep.
Moving on to Wednesday, August 10th, from the Batter's Box article, the start of a brand new day, this. From Dave Swan, J.D. Davis of the Giants went 3-for-4 with a home run, 1 RBI, and 2 runs. So far in 24 at-bats with the Giants, JD has 8 hits, with 3 of those being homers. The key for Davis is that he's getting more consistent playing time, which the Mets unfortunately couldn't give him. JD hits the ball very hard, always finishing around the top 10 to 15% of the league. With Longoria being older and often injured, I can see Davis as the Giants' everyday third baseman for the foreseeable future, and he should thrive in an everyday role. I love J.D. Davis. I thought he was always good with the Mets, and I wish he had more opportunity, but once Guillorme started playing a little bit better this season, J.D. Davis really had no place, so I'm happy he went to somewhere where he's getting regular playing time, and he's succeeding, because he seems like a really good dude. And then Leody Taveras of the Rangers. He went 2-for-4 with a double, a triple, a run, and 5 RBI. We've been waiting for Leody Taveras to get a legitimate chance in Texas, and this season, he's gotten the opportunity and is running with it. He's more speed-forward than power-focused, but in 50 games this season, Taveras has a 296, 329, 440 slash line with 3 home runs and 6 stolen bases. He's been batting in the middle of the lineup and doing pretty well. If you're in a 5-outfielder league or in a really deep league, Taveras is extremely helpful. He's someone that I've been rocking with in a 15-team league, and he's been great for average and some steals, so it's really great to see Leody Taveras piece together a good season. Although he hasn't played a full season, it's nice that he might be an everyday outfielder moving forward for this team. And also, lastly, Aaron Judge hit his 45th home run of the season on Wednesday, which just, wow. Judge has been an absolute monster this season, and he is going to get paid.
Yeah, Leody Taveras to me is like one of those interesting outfielder prospects because obviously, yeah, he's got the speed, but he still has that homer potential.
Yeah.
And I think the Rangers park isn't that great of a hitter's park, but you know, I think the jury's still out because the data needs to get collected and all that fun stuff.
Yeah.
But you know, he's in a good lineup. Semien and Seager obviously going to be there for years, so if he is able to bat, you know, middle of the lineup, he's got some good security around him. And yeah, Judge is a machine. He's amazing.
I mean, with a lineup of Semien, Seager, Garcia, Nate Lowe, and Leody Taveras, that's really solid. I mean, that's
yeah,
a pretty good front five guys, and it gives Taveras a lot of time to shine and rack in those RBIs like the 5 that he got on Wednesday.
Right. And, you know, they have that speed potential there, too. You got Semien there as well. So,
yep.
You know, got some chances to do some interesting stuff on the bases if, you know, people are on.
I agree. And moving on to pitchers from Wednesday, we have the SP Roundup article, Steal the Show, from Nick Pollock. Little segue here. I streamed Keegan Thompson and then Marcus Stroman on Monday and Tuesday.
No.
And I was going to stream Justin Steele on Wednesday. And why didn't I? I streamed Sean Manaea instead. And I was like, what am I doing? Anyways.
Yeah. So shout out to my friend Peter. I hate you. But you're also, I mean, we're facing each other this week in fantasy. I was going to stream Thor.
Okay.
And as a speculative pickup, I was like, if I don't get Thor, assuming someone else gets him, maybe I'll pick up Justin Steele as well. Because, you know, he had a really good game. I end up getting Thor. I don't get Steele because obviously I picked up Thor already. And I didn't drop someone else to get Steele. I didn't really feel like streaming two pitchers. That seems a little ambitious in a playoff game.
Right.
He picks up Steele.
Oh, no.
We're facing each other in the playoffs. Thor has a fine game.
Yeah.
Right?
Fine.
Like, Thor has a Thor game. It was like 6 innings, 4 strikeouts, 2 earned runs. It's like, that's what you want from Thor.
Yep.
And Steele goes on and just, man, what a performance. Like, what a time to just be like, I'm going to be a really good pitcher against, you know, my fantasy team.
Of course.
We don't talk about enough on this show of, you know, fantasy luck or maybe the lack thereof of luck. But, you know, that always seems to happen when you don't get the guy and he ends up performing really well against you.
That's been the epitome of my entire season, so I know what that means personally.
We're gonna have to do like a recap episode at the end of the season and just complain about all the things that went against us.
I would love that. I think at the end of the year we should have a complaining one where we just let everything loose. We just have a complaining podcast where we rant and we talk about everything that irked us and bothered us. I think that would be great. I think the viewers would really resonate with it.
Yeah, item number one on that list is Max Muncy.
that's fair. You make your list, I'll start making mine, and we'll be ready for that podcast.
Right, exactly.
But moving on to the pitchers for Wednesday, Kyle Wright of the Braves went 6 innings pitched, 1 earned run, 6 hits, 1 walk, 5 strikeouts against the Red Sox. I feel like we haven't spoken about Wright a lot this season. He's been phenomenal in this start. His curveball was carving up the Red Sox hitters. However, the fastball was down quite a bit in velocity. He was down a full 2 miles per hour on his fastball, making him sit at 92.5 miles per hour, which is definitely worrying. Now, he only pitched 143.1 innings pitched last season between AAA and MLB, and he's currently at 134.2 innings pitched, so maybe he's experiencing a little bit of fatigue, but it's something to keep an eye on. Regardless, Wright has had an amazing first full season with the Braves, and I'm excited about him for next season. Don't know what the future will hold, but I like Wright quite a lot. And then someone we've already talked about, Robbie Ray of the Mariners. He went 6.1 innings pitched, 2 earned runs, 3 hits, 5 walks, and 7 strikeouts against the Yankees. Like I said with Wright, I feel like we haven't talked a lot about Ray either, and now we've mentioned him twice in one show, so there's that. He's been looking awfully close to 2019 Robbie Ray, and not like 2021 Robbie Ray. We weren't expecting him to go out there and win another Cy Young, but this season he's proving to be the guy that he's always been. High ERA, lots of strikeouts, inconsistent fastball. In this start, he just couldn't locate his fastball, which is just quintessential Robbie Ray. But the sinker was performing well against a great offense, so he was able to have a pretty decent start, but an inflated whip. Hopefully, Ray can string together some starts with a lower whip as we approach the end of the fantasy year, but I'm holding my hand a little bit close to the cuff here because, I don't know, the strikeouts are high, but that ERA and whip are just a little bit too high for Ray. And lastly, shout out to Johnny Cueto of the White Sox, who just keeps getting quality starts. He's now at 8 consecutive quality starts after shutting down the Royals on Wednesday, so he's been a great pickup for you if you picked him up to stream or just get some quality starts in your league.
Yeah, Cueto's been, interestingly, like a really a fun story this year.
Definitely.
So, you know, what a resurgence, obviously. You know, White Sox picked him up off waivers, and he's turned into a good pitcher.
Yep.
Moving on to Thursday, August 11th performances. If you've been watching the Cardinals-Rockies series this week, which we just talked about with Miles Michaelis, it's been pretty much full of offense, not a lot of defense, to be completely honest. And yeah, Thursday's game was no different with 5 different players hitting homers. The one we want to call out is Brendan Rodgers of the Rockies, who went 1-for-4 with 3 RBIs and a homer. He had the decisive shot in the 7th inning, giving the Rockies the lead for good, and then helping them withstand an 8th inning comeback from the Cards with homers for both Goldie and Arenado. Rodgers has been having a pretty solid year. He's got 58 runs, 56 RBIs, they're both career highs for him, and he still has 2 more months to play baseball. He's cut down on the strikeout rate, up the walk rate, which you love to see. He has decent power potential, obviously, in Coors. That's nice to have. 34.3% hard contact rate. He does often hit those into the ground, though. So if he can up the fly ball rate to take full advantage of home games at Coors Field, he could be a really interesting guy down the stretch. And then Emmanuel Rivera of the Diamondbacks went 3-for-5 with 2 runs, a homer, and 3 RBIs. If you didn't know who Rivera was, he just got traded from the Royals to the Diamondbacks. He's had a pretty fun week as a snake. He's got 6 runs, 2 homers, and 4 RBIs in 6 games. We really don't expect him to keep this up for the rest of the season. Arizona has tried to get his bat in most games, though. He started, I think, 4 of those 6 games, and he's pinch hit in the other 2. So they definitely want to get him in there. He might be a speculative add in deep leaves if the power's there to stay and he has the playing time, but I would wait and see on that.
Yeah, for that Cardinals-Rockies series, I am against Goldschmidt, Arenado, and Ryan McMahon this week rough. In my main league. And then in other leagues, I'm also against Goldie, and it's been a disaster, especially because I have Edmund, and he's like the least productive Cardinal right now. And right. I don't know, it's been brutal to face that series in Colorado. It's been an offensive juggernaut.
Yeah, at least you didn't start Miles Michaelis.
That is very true. I did not.
Yeah. Speaking of Michaelis, moving on to pitchers, we have Dylan Cease of the White Sox going 6 innings, 3 hits, 1 earned run, 2 walks, and 8 strikeouts against the Royals. The only blip on Cease's day-to-day was actually giving up a homer to Vinny Pasquantino, who we talked about earlier. He was his dominant self for the rest of the day, got 13 whiffs alone on the slider. He did give up a little more hard contact than usual today, but the premium cherry bomb continues to give us reasons to start him. And then Edward Cabrera of the Marlins, 5.2 innings, 3 hits, 2 walks, and 6 strikeouts against the Phillies. He nearly pitched 6 shutout innings against the potent Phillies lineup, and while the changeup wasn't as dominant as we've expected to be, which is kind of funny to say considering that Cabrera has, like, pitched 5 games, I think, total this season.
Yeah.
He still has his slider working with a 28% whiff rate. He finished with an overall 31% CSW for the night. Unfortunately, he gets the Padres next, so probably skip that start. But it's always ridiculous to see, you know, what other pitchers the Marlins have come down the pipeline. Obviously, we had Max Meyer, who had to get Tommy John, but Edward Cabrera's, you know, one of those guys. Jesus Luzardo, another one of those guys. And then they managed to keep on to Pablo Lopez, which was great, you know, good for the Marlins. So definitely have a very dominant rotation coming up next season.
Yeah, they have a lot of exciting pitchers. Sandy, Pablo, Braxton Garrett emerging, Edward Cabrera, Sixto Sanchez, who's been hurt for like 3 years now, Max Meyer, just a lot of really good pitching there in Miami.
Trevor Rogers, too, if he figures it out.
Yeah, Trevor Rogers as well. Totally forgot he was down on the team.
Yeah.
Also, Dylan Cease has been like a top 5 pitcher this year. He's been nuts.
It's kind of insane because he has those blow-ups, right? He has always those blow-ups, but I feel like he's had less of them this season.
I just feel like he isn't walking the world this year, which is huge. I remember I could have kept him in my main keeper league last season, but every time I watched Dylan Cease, I wanted to turn the television off because he would walk like four people in the first inning. I'm like, what are you doing, dude? You're at 40 pitches in the first. Like, I couldn't take it, but now he's kind of negated that and he's been great. But now we will take a quick break, and when we come back, we'll be joined by pitcherless writer Dylan Drummy to talk about objectively measuring trades. Stay tuned. All right, we're back and joined by pitcherless writer Dylan Drummy to talk about his article, How Do You Objectively Measure a Trade? Welcome to the show, Dylan. How are you doing today?
Doing great. Thanks so much for asking. I'm excited to be on here.
Well, before we get into your article, first, let us know what you do at Pitcherless, what team you write for, what team you're a fan of, and your fantasy baseball experience.
Absolutely. So I am a going deep writer for Pitcher's List, and so I basically specialize. I mean, it's a lot of stuff, but mainly I try to go into deep stuff as far as like using data that we have available from RetroSheet and whatnot, looking at run environments is something I've done before. Shift data I've calculated, used, and I'm a bit newer to the team, but I've been writing somewhat prior to that beforehand, and I kind of look into that type of stuff. I am a Reds fan, which we're right now during the Field of Dreams game. That's pretty cool to see. And my fantasy baseball experience, I have been playing ever since I was kind of a little kid. I'm freshman in college right now, and I've been playing for a long time, usually head-to-head leagues with my friends a lot of times, but generally it's, you know, something that I've been able to do better with through knowing sabermetrics and stuff like that generally my friends don't know into that degree.
That's always the best when you could take advantage of your home league by knowing all the advanced metrics, even just knowing like Baseball Savant. Most of my friends don't know about Baseball Savant. They don't look into the extra numbers. So it's always good to get a leg up on your friends by knowing the very basics of sabermetrics, right?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. It's surprising how like things that you're able to acquire, guys that you're able to pick up for so cheap off the waiver wire, just getting and being able to take advantage of that and go to the championship.
Yeah, it's funny that you actually say you're a Reds fan and that you've been playing fantasy baseball for a while, because back in the day, one of my earliest fantasy baseball memories is being on an ESPN league with my friend David, and we actually drafted like Edwin Encarnacion as a third baseman on the Reds in his like rookie year or second year. It was really funny. I just remember always like Edwin Encarnacion in the 12th round was our third baseman, and that has never escaped my mind.
Yeah, he was horrendous for us. There is a reason he went to Toronto. There's a lot of those things that you just can't predict. Kind of like Josh Hamilton, like the guy was on drugs. You can't predict a lot of that stuff. A lot of guys have started with the Reds and then gone to be better afterwards and got their stuff together. But you know, he was not very good for us, but he was ultimately a very, very good player.
Yeah, I think it was in 2008. He hit 26 homers with a .251 batting average, and that's when I think I rostered him on a random ESPN league, which was probably for no money and was probably a 12-team league that I checked maybe five times.
So we're going to talk about your article. How do you objectively measure a trade? And you kind of start off the article with this framework of looking at trades in kind of three different ways, right? You talk about trading future talent for talent now, talk about trading need for need, and then trading expensive talent for cheaper talent. And obviously this is the context of real world trades. But obviously, as you know, fantasy baseball managers, we tend to not care too much about, you know, why teams are trading. We care more about, you know, where players are going and things like that. Unless, you know, you're participating in like a dynasty league and, you know, where prospects go and things like that is actually an important part of understanding how to play fantasy baseball in those types of formats. And so a lot of times, you know, we look at trades and the concept of, you know, rest of season sort of things. But also, you know, it is August. It is kind of coming to the end of fantasy baseball season for a lot of us. And we're starting to look, even though it's, you know, probably 6 months away, into drafts for next year. So there's definitely some interesting things to talk about in regards to trades and how they can help us in fantasy baseball. So kind of want to start off. It's With trade deadline season just finishing, it's hard to not talk about the trade deadline without talking about Juan Soto. Definitely this was a trade, weirdly enough, to trade like future talent for talent now, even though Soto's 23 and he was still, I think he was maybe the oldest of the young players who were in that trade, but he was only like, I think, a few months older than Mackenzie Gore, who was shipped over to the Nationals. But yeah, what did you think about this trade? What was your initial reaction to that? And how do you think the Padres ended up doing in that trade? And also, ultimately, what does Juan Soto's outlook look like for the rest of the season?
Absolutely. So I'll start off with whatever people believe about batting average or whatnot, they like to look at his batting average. I don't. I don't regard that as a thing. So I think that's important. I look at Juan Soto, what he's done this year, the value that he's produced, and I consider him to be a top 10 hitter in the game. He is truthfully like. Whatever you say, that's why it was such a big deal that he was traded. You do not see talent like this move and talent with this much control. He still has 2.5 years left. He'll get a lot in arbitration, but he still has 2.5 years of control that a team doesn't have to move him. So I think that was definitely like important in considering the trade. And I know the Nationals don't need him for 2.5 years, but the biggest problem that I like have when judging this, and this is kind of mentioned in my article, is it's hard to know the market, especially for a guy like that. Usually you judge a market based off comps, what's happened previously this year, what's happened in the past. A guy like Soto doesn't have comps. You can't look at that. You can't see what he's done, like what a guy like that has fetched. So while my immediate reaction was, okay, yeah. The Nationals just got screwed, and that was my first like thought, and then I'm like, well, I also don't know their competing offers. I have to assume it would be the best, but if that was the best, then was it really the best time to trade Juan Soto? And there's a lot of factors at play there. I like the Nationals' return somewhat. They definitely did not win this trade as far as Juan Soto is just so valuable. You can't replace him. And Josh Bell too. I mean, he's a mercenary, don't get me wrong, but he's been really, really good this year. I've liked him, but I mean, they got at least a decent return. And I mean, and Gore, Abrams, I mean, I like Hassel. I'm a big Hassel guy. But it's you can't there isn't a scenario where I say like I'm kind of against winners and losers. So I mean for what San Diego's trying to do, like they got an A, I would give it about, and then I would give like San Diego something like a low B probably would be the most accurate, maybe a high C. It's hard to tell and to be absolute with just no market value knowledge, you know?
And how do you feel about Soto? Like obviously moving to the Padres, it's a lot of people were like, oh, it's a terrible park, but how do you think his fantasy outlook looks like for the rest of the season?
I mean, I don't think people should worry. I mean, I don't think his performance is going to drastically decrease or increase with leagues with RBIs. He'll obviously benefit with a better team around him. I mean, it obviously depends on what you're valuing, what categories you're playing, what if you're playing categories, roto, if you're playing head to head. But I mean, I think like head to head, at least his value will be fine. If anything, he may produce a teensy bit less, but I mean, I would argue that there's not a lot of variation that's going to happen in the second half. I can't be an all foretelling predictor, but from what I've seen, the statistics I've seen from that, I don't see him changing much in the second half.
Yeah, for me, it's crazy to think of Juan Soto being traded just because, I mean, all of the players that were in return to the Nationals are older than Juan Soto. It's just absolutely wild to think about that aspect where you're trading away the youngest, one of the most talented players in all of baseball for a bunch of what ifs. We've said that on this podcast a few times, specifically in our trade podcast from recapping the trade deadline. But I just couldn't believe that the Nationals traded away Juan Soto and all of the other guys they traded away, Trey Turner and Max Scherzer, just all these guys. It's just pretty remarkable to see the Nationals blowing it up after winning a World Series in 2019, but it makes sense. And looking at the trade from the other end, you brought up all of the other pieces that came back. There's a lot of young talent going to the Nationals, including Mackenzie Gore, CJ Abrams, Robert Hassel III, who I am also a big fan of. In terms of future value, are any of these guys on your radar for players to pick up next year in redraft leagues, or are they more of deeper picks?
If you're playing Dynasty, Hassel's definitely a consideration.
Should definitely be rostered by now already, I would think.
Yeah. I mean, that's what I would imagine with how far up he is. As far as regular leagues, I'm a Gore fan. I mean, I think he's got a lot of potential. Abrams has struggled with the power stuff in the major league, and it worries me. Like, I've looked at his contact numbers, and they're not as far as what he does on contact, not actual. He's a good at least slap hitter, but what he does on contact is not great, so that's worrisome. Gore, I feel like, has got a lot of potential. He was ever performing when he went through that miraculous run in the first half. He was, like, doing really, really well, and he was overperforming, and he started to regress a bit. But I think that these guys that in a redraft league, I think Mackenzie Gore should be a target, at least. I mean, Hassel, I don't think will be ready yet. Mm-hmm. I mean, he might get a shot, but it would be, if he does, I don't know. It depends on the size of your league. It depends on how deep. In a shallow league, 10-man, probably even a 12-man, I wouldn't do it. If you get a 14, though, 16, he may be worth a flyer. Gore, definitely. Abrams, I just feel like you can find somebody better than him.
Yeah, that's right. A great point. Mackenzie Gore started off real strong this year, like you said, and then just fell off a cliff. And I think his potential is very, very high. I think he could be really good. He could be an ace in the future. This year, obviously, had some bumps in the road, but I see a lot of big things. I think he will be drafted next season and probably will give you some value. CJ Abrams, I agree with you. His just contact is not too great in terms of hard hit balls and power. He reminds me a lot of like a Jeff McNeil, but with a lot more speed.
Yeah.
And that's not too bad. I mean, hey, if he steals 30 bases or 25 bases and gives you maybe 5 home runs, he's kind of rosterable, I guess. And Robert Hassel, yeah, I don't think he comes up by next season. I think he'll probably be ready in 2, maybe 3, but I think that they're not looking to call him up right away and kind of manipulate that service time a little bit. And also going back to your point with grading the trade, I think the Padres would end up getting an A+ out of this trade if they managed to sign Juan Soto long term, but I do not think that's happening.
Interesting. Well, yeah, it's so, and I'm hesitant with an A+ because they did give up a lot. So let's acknowledge that they
did give up a
big portion of their future. So I would think I'm definitely hesitant to do something like that because it's not a win-win. I generally reserve trades like for A+. It's just from my personal standpoint. An A+ is a win-win.
Oh, definitely.
There's no downside. There's only upside, and I can't argue that case with Soto. And I mean, it's. So, I mean, like, an example, I mean the Castillo trade, that's one of them that's, I'm like, the Reds will never use him. They don't need him in the next 1.5 years, and they got a haul. That's a clear A+.
Yeah.
But it's stuff like that. I definitely think San Diego got as far as, like, they got a lot of what they needed. And I think it depends on the playoffs, too. If they manage to make the playoffs in the next 2 years and get the revenue that comes with making the playoffs, I think it'll be worth it. If they don't, you could argue it's based off expected value, and expected value would help that, but I think it'll ultimately come down to, do they make the playoffs or not?
Sure.
And if they don't, I would argue that, like, you start to lean at least to an A-, B+.
Yeah.
If they do, I would be definitely an A.
Yeah. Well, moving on to another trade, also involving the Padres, funny enough. One of the categories where you mentioned is trading expensive talent for cheaper talent. I think that's where this falls, but I'm a little biased because I'm a big Taylor Rogers fan. But the Brewers traded Josh Hader, who had, about a year and a half left of control, for Taylor Rogers, some other pieces from the Padres. They weirdly, like, DFA'd Denelson Lamet, but, you know, they got some guys back who have some interesting promise. But Taylor Rogers is, you know, a major league closer for all intents and purposes. When we look at positions like relief pitcher, how do you grade a trade like that?
Well, okay, so I'll start off with this. I don't value relief pitchers very highly whatsoever, as far as, like, I understand the specialist mentality of a relief pitcher, but as far as their value and their cost, I don't love teams spending like I like the Padres got Hader, right? And they're going to probably keep him on next year through like his I'm not sure if that's his last year of arbitration or second, I forget. But I think estimates suggest they're going to pay him around $16 million next year. He's making about 11 now. And I can't personally, if I were to run a franchise, I could never justify paying a closer for $16 million a year. That's also partially because a closer isn't, I believe the closer is a very outdated concept just in general, but that's a little sabermetricy that I'm not going to rant about. So I think, sure. Yeah, so I think it was a salary dump for general. I think that Josh Hader's definitely better than Taylor Rogers.
Right, yep.
But I like how Rogers throws the ball. I like his. I think the Brewers have some of the best pitching dev in the league.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's something to consider with Rogers and Hader. Hader's sinker, I've seen some data, is looking a bit different than in prior years and is not. I think it's his release extension on it or something to that degree where he's releasing it. It's just a lot different than his prior years and it's been inconsistent. So when I looked at that, I think the Padres or the Brewers realized something was wrong. And I think that's kind of why they were open to trading Hader. And I mm-hmm. think they believe they can do something with Rogers. So ultimately, I think Milwaukee won this trade or I mean, not really won, but I think that the value that they got from it, as far as they got in my personal opinion, a quality reliever. They've got a couple of prospects. Lamet was DFA'd, so that's not a non-factor when I mm-hmm. really look at it. But ultimately, I think that like this was, as far as for the longevity of the Brewers franchise, this was great. As far as for San Diego, I don't know how they're going to afford all this. And I, you know, some luxury tax caps or thresholds will be broken.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I mean, you mentioned, you know, you kind of don't value relievers. And I think a lot of people, you know, similarly would agree in that, like, sometimes it's not worth it to go for that Hader or for that Hendricks in, you know, the second or third round, as, you know, sometimes they go that high crazy enough in fantasy baseball. But I kind of like, you know, Rogers seems, this kind of feels like a fun little trade where you get to see, all right, Rogers isn't as good of a closer as Hader, but does he offer the same value fantasy wise at the end of the day for teams? And I think a lot of people would argue that yes, Hader does have better ratios, but from a fantasy outlook, you kind of get the same thing that you get from Rogers that you'll get from Hader.
Yeah, I would 100% agree. I have both. Actually, on a
oh really nice
yeah I was I did a reliever trade earlier in the year and managed to I picked Rogers was a steal when I drafted him and he started off so hot but uh-huh. So I think they're like as far as fantasy value I mean they're very very close in my opinion is like especially with the value they'll be providing both are now I mean both are on good teams so. Mm-hmm. Saves. I mean, Rogers should fill out that ninth inning role. Still waiting for it to pan out, you know, and see what Devin Williams does and whatnot. Right. But, you know, I think that fantasy value wise, this doesn't change much for him. Mm-hmm. You know, like I still think they're worth roughly the equivalent of when before this trade.
Yeah.
I mean, for me, I think Hader's just better than Rogers. I mean, you could say they're kind of the same. They're going to get you probably the same amount of saves neck and neck, but the strikeouts per innings pitch for Hader is just way above Rogers, and that's one of the main reasons you want him. The security around Josh Hader is a little bit more secure than Rogers. He's been a setup guy. He's been a closer, bouncing around from team to team. So I would much rather Hader, but I agree with the sentiment that Rogers and Hader essentially, I mean, especially rest of season, are going to give you roughly the same thing.
Yeah. And I mean, I think you got it. I would not be surprised to see Taylor Rogers get better as the Brewers.
Oh, completely.
I would be on the lookout for that because I think the Brewers are very, very educated on that stuff. And I think that honestly, they can do something with them.
Yeah, the Brewers are really good at developing pitchers, like you said. And speaking of pitchers, two of the top pitchers who were traded were Frankie Montas and Luis Castillo, which you mentioned earlier. Both moves were definitely trading future talent for talent now to help teams win and hopefully win that World Series. But how do those trades, in your opinion, which player ended up in a better situation for the rest of the season?
So when considering the fantasy aspect of this, I'll start with Castillo because I'm a Red fan, as I said. So
exactly.
I mean, don't get me wrong. I've met Luis Castillo. I've seen him pitch countless games through his tenure with the Reds. But I would be lying if I said I saw that trade package and wasn't a bit giddy. You know?
Oh, for sure.
What they got in the return for that. But yeah, you look at Castillo, obviously, big upgrade as far as wins goes. I mean, Seattle's acting like a competitive team. I'm not completely sold on it. I was very skeptical of them last year, and I'm still skeptical about them this year. So I think, well, at least get, bottom line, the Mariners are better than the Reds. So let's do that there. So wins, I mean, you're obviously going to have a lot there. Reds are okay at defense. They're not very great. Seattle's at least, I think, somewhat decent, I want to say. I don't think they're in the bottom tier. Don't hold me to that. But I think that Seattle should, in theory, have a better defense. Not guaranteed. But, you know, I think when you really look at it, it's you're going to get a lot more wins. You're going to have – they're going to be using them. They're definitely going to be using them as much as possible. He's going to be that front man. And he'll have the run support to garner those. So he gets an upgrade, in my opinion. Frankie Montas, going to New York, by the way. It was surprising to see what New York traded for him.
Right.
You know, considering what the Reds got for Castillo.
Exactly,
And when you look at Montas and Castillo, one stat I like to use is a predictive classified run average and stat by Connor Kirkon, and meant to be, it's one of the best predictive estimates of ERAs out there. And you look at all of that, and you look at all that data, and I mean, these guys are like half a run difference. I think they're very, very comparable. Castillo's better, but Montas is a close second, I would think. So Montas, so that differential didn't really make sense to me, but or the Reds just were doing something right.
Right. I was just going to say, Noelvi Marte, just for starters, like far and away, you know, the best player among the two trades who got traded in terms of prospect wise. Like the fact that the Yankees only traded their best was like their number five pitcher on their prospect, like the number five prospect on their list, was incredible to me.
Yeah, and so I, as part of one of my articles, so like I said, Red fan, I'm from Cincinnati, I'm from around the Cincinnati area, and for the blog I still write for that I kind of started on my own and do besides Pitcher List, with Pitcher's List as well, I wrote about a piece of designing a Reds rebuild. And I looked at Castillo was one of the factors that in that piece I said we need to get rid of him. I actually, funny thing is, I had him going to Seattle thing. Yeah, it was in April, and I'm like, huh, that panned out. But I had a much lesser package. I was aghast when I saw what the Reds got. I mean, I had them getting Marte, and I think one other person, and it wasn't even a high level prospect. I think it was between 10 and 15, I want to say. And I'm like, and it was like, and some people were telling me they saw that and they're like, isn't that a bit much for him? And I'm like, oh. And then, you know, hindsight, you know, just comes at me, and I'm like, well, I guess I underestimated a bit. when I saw what we got, but that's kind of trailing off topic. But Montas, like I said, on a better team. Yankees are not very hot right now, but I mean, I think they'll still be a great team to end the year. I don't take hot streaks with much credibility anyways. It's just clustering of my opinion of data. But so I think a guy like Montas will, I mean, more wins. I mean, that's what you're looking at for these guys. That's kind of the big differential. I mean, New York is generally it's a pretty hitter-friendly park, but I still don't feel like Montas will struggle very much. He'll still be pretty valuable.
Sure.
Yeah, Montas is a great pitcher, and Yankee Stadium is a little bit of a bandbox, but he should still be great. That splitter's nasty, and Luis Castillo on the Mariners just Great haul for the Reds getting all those players back. But it was excellent talking trade with you and going over your article, How Do You Objectively Measure a Trade? Dylan, before you go, please let people know what your Twitter is and where they can find you outside of your work on Pitcher List.
Absolutely. So my Twitter is at Drummy Dylan. It should be in the description how my name's spelled. I write for one other site, which is my own, which is called The Drummy Angle, which is my last name, Angle. And basically there I do like the stuff I do on Pitcher's List. So I go into a lot of research and theory and whatnot about just different aspects of the game. I love talking about baseball, and I'm really glad you guys had me on, and I would love being to discuss the applications. How do you objectively measure a trade in fantasy?
Yeah, once again, Dylan, thank you so much for joining us.
Absolutely. You guys have a great night.
Now, to finish things off, let's get into the streamers for the weekend. John, what do you have for us this week?
Yeah, a lot of aces are going this weekend, so streamers were a little hard to find, so I apologize in advance if you start any of these guys and it goes really poorly for you.
Yeah, these are actually gross.
I tried, guys. I tried, I swear. On Saturday, we have Dylan Bundy of the Twins. He's 10% rostered on Yahoo, 90% rostered on ESPN. He's going against the Angels. That's the only reason why I'm selecting this. If you're in a quality start league, like, stay away from this start. But if you need help in ratios, Bundy might be an interesting pickup here. Angels' offense is notoriously bad right now, even though they have the ability to hit a lot of homers if everything works right for them. Bundy's still able to give you 4, and if you're lucky, 5 innings of good pitching as long as the slider is working. It has worked in the past. I was looking at his game log, and it's ugly. But if you need some help and you need a guy, sure, you could try Dylan Bundy. There's other guys available on your waiver wire that you might be able to pick up. Like Aaron Ashby, I think, is available on most leagues. Reed Detmers might be available in some of your leagues. Some of those guys might be better if they just, don't fall under the 20% threshold that we have. On Sunday, we have Jordan Lyles of the Orioles. He's 23% rostered in Yahoo, 11% rostered on ESPN. He's going up against the Rays. He actually has had a couple good starts in the past month. Ironically, the last bad start he had was against the Rays, so knock on wood. Hopefully this one doesn't turn out like that one. The stats really aren't pretty for Lyles. He's got a 4.35 ERA and a 1.44 whip, but no one cares about that when you're streaming. You just want a guy who can pitch one good game, and he might be able to do that against the Rays. And then finally, rounding out on Monday, we got Glenn Otto of the Rangers. He's 3% rostered in Yahoo, 1% rostered on ESPN. He goes up against the A's. And again, when it comes to streaming, we love recency bias, right? We always look at what their last 2-3 starts were and see if they're on a heater. Otto has turned into relatively decent starts. He limited the Astros and the White Sox to 2 runs each in his past 2 starts. And a reasonable strikeout total, nothing crazy. But now he gets the rewarded with the A's, who are still not good this season. So yeah, go ahead, stream him, see how that works out. I can't say it's going to be amazing, but you might get a quality start out of it.
Yeah, these are gross, like we said. And if I had to rank them for the ones I like the best, I would probably put it in reverse order. I like Otto, then Lyles, then Bundy.
Yep.
And the thing is at this point in the season, all of the bad offenses are kind of established. You know who they are. You know who you could take advantage of. The A's, the Angels, the Rockies on the road, the Nationals, the Rays at some points. Like, these are the same teams that we recommend all of the streamers. So if you even don't take our recommendations, when you're trying to stream, make sure that you're going against one of those offenses, because even if the pitcher's not great, they'll probably get a good start because their offense is not good. So make sure you take advantage of the A's, the Nationals, the Angels, all the teams that are just not producing offensively right now.
Yeah, I think there might be some Cubs pitchers you could pick on because they are facing the Nationals this weekend, I believe.
Yep.
I think it's just maybe a Sunday, Monday, Tuesday sort of series. But yeah, if Keegan Thompson's available in your league, or maybe even Justin Steele, they might be worth a look at for sure. If they're probably available in your leagues, there's just not as rostered, like 20% lower. So that's why we weren't able to select them.
Yeah, I just streamed all of the Cubs pitching staff against the Nationals because they're not good. So just make sure you know what offenses your pitchers are going against and who to stream against, because there are very obvious candidates out there for the bad offenses that you can definitely take advantage of. But that wraps up the streamers for the weekend. And before you go, make sure you follow our podcast on Twitter at ThisWeekPL and send us your comments and questions to our email at ThisWeekPLPod@gmail.com. You can also find John on Twitter at TheJohnKe. That's THEJOHNKE. And you can find myself on Twitter at Regicidal. That's REGICIDAL. Also, make sure that you follow or subscribe to this podcast on whatever platform you listen to your podcasts on, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, wherever else, and make sure you leave us a 5-star review because it helps our show out. And lastly, sign up for Pitcherless Plus. By doing so, you can join us in the Pitcherless Discord and get advice from all of the fantasy experts and writers over there. But that's all for this week. We will be back next week recapping another week in fantasy baseball. For John, I am Lee. We'll see you all in the next one. Later, everyone.